I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ashton Carter is President Obama's pick to be his new Secretary of Defense. If confirmed, he would head up a $600 billion a year department with almost 3 million employees that former Defense Secretary Bill Gates called a gargantuan labyrinthine bureaucracy. Obama has had three secretaries of defense in almost 6 years with the resignation of Chuck Hagel, who served less than two. It's been reported he left under pressure and was frustrated with White House micromanaging foreign policy. Hagel was also criticized for his rocky performance at his confirmation hearing and for being passive at meetings. He reportedly disagreed with Obama's Syria strategy. We have two guests who have joined us to talk about U.S. foreign policy, the Defense Department, the relationship between the White House and the Pentagon, President Obama's choice of Ashton Carter and Hagel's tenure. And let me introduce them to you. Gordon Adams is a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center, professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, a co-author of a new book called Mission Creep, The Militarization of Foreign Policy. Gordon Adams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Mark Thompson, and he has covered national security and the military in Washington since 1979 and for Time since 1994. Mark Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
You bet it, Marty.
Let's begin with this choice of Ashton Carter. To you, Mark Thompson, what do you make of that choice?
Well, I think it's basically a continuation on autopilot. Let's face it, at the end of a second term of a president, the president, does not have much leverage. And the people working for him at the tail end of his tenure are only going to be able to basically do things at the margin. I think Ash Carter will make a fine defense secretary, given the circumscribed role he'll be able to play in this administration.
What's your assessment, Gordon Adams?
I would describe Ash Carter as the anti-Hagel. He is many things that Chuck Hagel was not. Hagel was, in many respects, a very weak secretary. He was weak inside the building vis-a-vis the chiefs. He was weak vis-a-vis the White House, where he rarely talked in meetings. And he didn't begin to have the clout on with the Congress that people expected a former Republican senator to have. Carter is none of those things. Carter is a very smart technician, a technical guy, an academic and a policymaker, somebody who's done three previous spins, at least in the Department of Defense, and a lot of consulting at the same time. He's a guy who really knows the business. Now, that said, I fully agree with Mark Thompson. There are some huge challenges. You're in the last 2 years of an administration. The amount of clout you've got is disappearing. He's got a White House that micromanages. He's got Joint Chiefs that are kind of out of control. He's got a Hill that wants to get the president. He's going to have, you know, a vertical challenge in terms of doing anything terribly different in the Pentagon.
To you, Mark Thompson, and if approved, Ashton Carter would be the fourth Secretary of Defense under Obama. Does that seem like a lot of people in that position in 6 years?
Yeah, sure it does. I mean, it's a 2-year tenure is a bit truncated. The government likes to keep its chairman of the Joint Chiefs in for 4 years, and that generally is the way it goes. Defense secretaries don't always last that long, but both Cap Weinberger and Don Rumsfeld were in for 6 or 7 years apiece. Now, obviously, there are some folks who stay a shorter period of time. But every 2 years does make the building a bit choppy, the building being the Pentagon, and it's tough to get acclimated to guy number one when guy number two is coming in so quickly.
But, and I'm comparing that to, let's say, secretaries of state. Back to you, Mark Thompson. I mean, is this a particularly difficult job?
Well, it's an all-consuming job. Anyone you've ever spoken with who's held it will tell you that. Whenever you're awake, you are the Secretary of Defense. You pace yourself. You can do it. There are ups and downs associated with the job. And it's not beyond the capability of any person to hold it for some extended period of time.
To you, Gordon Adams, and you describe Chuck Hagel as a weak Secretary of Defense. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah, it's curious. When Chuck Hagel was appointed, people remember that rather lugubrious confirmation hearing that he had, where he didn't appear to know what he was talking about and was a little bit like a deer caught in the headlights. You know, there's an aspect apparently to Chuck Hagel that's a deer caught in the headlights almost any time of day.
Really?
Yeah, that is silent, that is not very clear about policy direction, that is not standing up for things. That when he speaks or briefs is very, very general, who apparently took information on 3x5 cards, not even 8.5x11 briefing pages. Not a person of deep substance, not somebody who knew the department very well. And, you know, as Mark Thompson's implying, you have to stay around a while, especially if you come into a building like Hagel with no background in defense policy issues or defense management. You know, being a sergeant in Vietnam is fine and honorable, but it doesn't cut it when you have to run a building. So he was extremely weak, and the consequence of his being weak, I think, is very troubling to me at least. And that is that the service chiefs have gotten a little bit out of the box. General Dempsey, who's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has kind of become the defense spokesperson for the administration, not a good position for the chairman to be in. He's supposed to give advice privately to the president, not be the spokesperson. And especially on the budget, where the chief of staff of the Army, General Odierno, and General Dempsey have both been out visibly, publicly, vocally campaigning for more money for the Department of Defense, more money than the president has requested, and they have been vigorous about it, even at the edge of what I think is acceptable practice for a service secretary. So Hagel really has not minded the store for the last couple of years, and as a result, the employees in the store have gotten a bit unruly. Mm.
Do you think, though, looking ahead and assuming it gets confirmed, that Ashton Carter can rein in some of those powerful people?
You know, it's going to be a big challenge. The thing about the permanent bureaucracy at the Defense Department, and that's the services and the service chiefs, is that they can outweigh any secretary. Secretaries come and go. Even though some have served long, the average tenure is around 2 years, so Hagel's not that unusual. And they can wait them out and keep pushing and keep pressing, and they are there forever. Carter is a very, very smart guy. He's got a lot of experience. He knows the people in the building. They know him. He's capable of decisive action. The question really is going to be, does he have the political space to take it? Will the administration give him the room to push back? Will he want to push back? Part of the problem here is the budget. Carter's been very out front about seeking more money for the Pentagon, too, which means disciplining the system in the department has not been very strong for the last 4 years, either under Panetta or under Hagel. And only the Budget Control Act budget caps have been holding the line with respect to defense.
Mark Thompson, and this is something that I read about Chuck Hagel and even looking ahead to Ashton Carter and perhaps even some previous secretaries of defense under the Obama administration, that a lot of the policy comes out of the White House. Is that your assessment? And is that unusual? Is that a problem?
It's not my assessment, Marty. It's the assessment of Bob Gates. It's the assessment of Leon Panetta. And if you talk to Hagel's people, it's the assessment of Hagel's people as well. Listen, as Gordon was just pointing out, with the chiefs and the ascendancy and the chairman arguing for more money, nature and Washington both abhor a vacuum. And effectively, in the Pentagon for the last 2 years, Chuck Hagel has served as a vacuum. And into that space, Dempsey, Odierno, and the others have expanded. It's just almost like a force of nature. Now, Ash Carter's not anything like that. He's very outspoken. He will let you know by body language, if not explicitly, that he thinks he's a pretty smart guy, and apparently he is. But the fact is that beyond the budget stuff, in terms of our battles with ISIS, our issues with Iran, with Russia, a lot of those decisions have been made at the NSC and inside the White House. The Pentagon basically has sort of been there, as they are supposed to be, you know, saluting and carrying out the orders. But you do get the impression that the NSC folks really aren't listening to a lot of what the Pentagon is telling them, not taking this kind of thing seriously. And we've seen that, you know, when on the rise of ISIS, you know, people were screaming about this for quite a while before the White House finally woke up and paid attention. And in the same way, you know, they were eager to get out of Iraq, not leave a residual force behind, when a lot of folks, including Panetta and others, believe that the U.S. could have fought harder to keep folks inside Iraq into 2012, and that ISIS never would have gained a foothold in that country.
Gordon Adams, how do you see the current relationship between then the Pentagon and the White House?
I think that relationship has been tense and difficult and conflictual since the very beginning of the Obama administration. It seems that there not only is there an instinct in the White House to bring all policy decisions into the White House network and the National Security Council. That's been obvious because the National Security Council staff has ballooned, practically doubling in the last 6 years. So there's now a lot of micromanagers over at the NSC, but there's been persistent tension. You talk to anybody on the defense side and even on the National Security Council side, this instinct to operate things and manage decisions out of the White House has created just an endless pattern of tension. I think personally it's one of the reasons that Michelle Flournoy, who might have been the first female Secretary of Defense in American history, turned down the job when, I know she was offered it, but when it was discussed over the last 10 days or so, she apparently turned it down, and I think it may be partly because she and Ash Carter have been involved in the department and involved in that tension and know that there is a constant back and forth. Now, I've served in an administration. I've sat in Situation Room meetings with policymakers who are making those kinds of decisions. And if it's constant competition, tension, backbiting, pushing back and forth, it just doesn't work very well in policy terms. If it's more cooperative, even when they disagree, you get better policy as a result. So I don't expect that to change. The White House is the White House. The National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, is the National Security Advisor. She's a tough infighter. She will make her point of view very clear. The president clearly welcomes her in the National Security Council. That sets the tone for the rest of the interaction. So I think, not only is Carter going to have a challenge with the chiefs, who have gotten a little obstreperous in the last 4 years, he's going to have a persistent set of tensions and friction and sandpaper-like relationship with the White House, too.
Mark, about a minute before our first break here, should we make anything of the fact that Chuck Hagel was not at Obama's side when he announced the name of Ashton Carter on Friday?
Well, the Pentagon was saying as of Thursday evening that he would be there. And then early Friday, it was reporters were told, well, no, he won't. Hagel bolted as soon as he knew he had lost the president's confidence a couple of weeks ago. And the White House said, okay, just stay quiet until we line up your successor. He refused and went public with his resignation letter, and it was the president and Hagel together at the White House. And then last week it was Carter and the president there without Hagel. And so that does send a big message. It seems picayune to a lot of folks, but in reality, theater has its own substance. And when you don't have the incoming and the outgoing defense secretaries there with the commander-in-chief, it is somewhat disconcerting, both inside the building as well as to the greater world that pays attention to these things.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Mark Thompson and Gordon Adams. We are talking about the fact that President Obama has nominated Ashton Carter to serve as his fourth defense secretary. We are talking about what life is like inside the Pentagon, the relationship between the Pentagon and White House, much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Gordon Adams. He's a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center and professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University. Spent a number of years serving in the Clinton administration, co-author of a new book called Mission Creep, The Militarization of Foreign Policy. We unfortunately lost Mark Thompson. He had to run up to the Hill for his job, and he has been covering national security in the military for time. And again, to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at whyy radio times. To you, Gordon Adams, is part of what's perhaps facing the Obama administration and even the United States is that when Obama ran for president, he really talked about sort of a disengagement, getting out of Iraq, getting out of Afghanistan. And now we seem to be engaged in a policy of engagement or re-engagement around the world. Can you speak to that?
You know, I think the president has had a real struggle, and many presidents do. Not every president comes to the office with a broad knowledge of foreign policy. My old boss, Bill Clinton, didn't come with broad knowledge of foreign policy. He traveled abroad, but he was governor of Arkansas, and he hadn't served in the Congress. So he didn't even have much experience of Washington itself. The consequence of that is that there's a learning curve, and the president kind of has to discover over time that he has things to do in the foreign policy arena. He's got to get up that learning curve. He's got to figure out the issues. He's got to deal with world leaders. And he has to define what he thinks the American position is going to be. I actually think that the way Obama has laid it out in his first term is pretty close to right. That is to say, the world is rebalancing. The world's changing. Other countries are coming up. The U.S. can't simply say frog these days and have everybody else jump. So he's got to find ways to shape relationships with international organizations, with other countries, so that, you know, policies can be pursued and countries will buy in and other countries can be heard. I think that's a realistic approach to the world, but it's extremely challenging. Mm. And for those who think foreign policy is something that only happens overseas, he's been very challenged, largely by the Republicans in the Congress, about his international leadership and about events simply cannot control, events that happen in other countries that we don't make happen but then pose problems for American security. So foreign policy is a challenging job for a president. He, like all presidents, has had to learn the wicket, get on top of it, learn how to pitch, and begin to wade in. After a while, he discovered it was probably pretty interesting and pretty fun, but in this changing world, really hard.
Indeed. Well, I wonder, even in the 21st century, is it possible to have, you know, a president's doctrine in order to meet all the challenges of the world? We know about the Monroe Doctrine and other doctrines from past presidents, and this president has been criticized for not having this kind of one-size-fits-all doctrine for the world. Do you think that fits?
No, I don't think you can have a one-size-fits-all doctrine. We just went through a presidency that had a one-size-fits-all doctrine. George Bush, whether you agreed or not, made it clear that as far as he was concerned, America had to act and act alone if necessary, that it had to deal with terrorists, it had to stop nuclear proliferation, especially to terrorists, and it had to promote democracy around the world through a process of regime change. We paid a severe price as a nation for that. It cost us people. It cost us wounded. It cost us money. It cost us psychic disturbance. It cost us allies. It cost us friends. And part of what the dilemma that President Obama's had to deal with is the cleaning up, the sweeping up after a presidency with a very clear doctrine. It's a complex world.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a clear doctrine, and the American ability to simply say we are the leader, therefore things are going to follow when we set the track, is just not true anymore. We can't say to anybody else now, you know, join us or get out of the way, which is kind of what the Bush presidency said.
Well, do you think after 6 years he's still doing cleanup? I mean, clearly we're still engaged in Iraq. There are now some recent calls. The president says 1,000 more people will be at least temporarily in Afghanistan. So we are still engaged in those two countries. We are also obviously engaged in the Middle East and Syria and ISIS. We are still a country at war.
Yes, and that area, this must feel like a sticky substance that the president can't rid himself of, because what he announced as a major feature of his national security strategy was the pivot to the Pacific, the rebalancing of American foreign policy. And while there has been a lot of movement towards China, a lot of progress, actually, towards China, a lot of movement both on the military and the diplomatic and the economic side to the Asian theater, this sticky wicket of the Middle East just keeps getting attached to whatever president touches it. You can't get the Palestinians and the Israelis together. You can't solve the Iraqi governance crisis. You can't deal with the civil war in Syria. You can't bring it to a successful conclusion in Afghanistan. Most of those things, particularly Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iraq, were begun in the Bush administration. And they were left as problems that this president had to deal with because we had forces deployed forward. He's tried to pull them back. He's pulled them down quite successfully. But you cannot, from Washington, D.C., actually govern Afghanistan or govern Iraq. I actually disagree with something that Mark said. He's no longer here to argue with me about it. But I don't think if the United States had left, you know, two divisions in Iraq, that the situation with ISIS would have been any different, because the problem wasn't the American military presence. The problem was the government of Iraq, which stepped on the Sunni community in western Iraq to the point where the Sunni community signed up with ISIS because they were no longer being respected by Baghdad. That's a problem the White House simply cannot control, and until we lose our illusion that we can just say things and things happen, we're going to run into those kinds of problems.
Let me ask you about ISIS and the U.S. bombing campaign against ISIS. It looks, at least on the ground, as if ISIS, I don't know if they're exactly winning or not, but they're certainly not being defeated. The president talks about degrading and destroying ISIS. Do you think, from your perspective, that's even possible?
No, I don't think the United States can do that. The only people who can do that are the countries in the region. And if you look at the concentric circle around ISIS, it's a pretty weak prospect. The Iraqi government is going to be at least a couple of years before their military forces are up to speed to challenge ISIS. The Peshmerga for the Kurds, a force from the north part of Iraq, are pretty good, but they're going to need equipment and training. The Syrian opposition is, moderate opposition, is utterly hopeless in a military sense, which means ISIS pretty much has a free hand in Syria and confronts only the Bashar al-Assad government that's not very popular right now, but has a lot of means of violence. The Saudis have got to step up to this. The Egyptians have got to step up to this. The only real answer in this region is the countries in the region. If you wanted a little micro model of this, it's kind of what we did in Afghanistan at the beginning in 2001. The Northern Alliance was the ground force. The Americans were the air force. If you really wanted to prevail against ISIS, you need a ground force. The United States cannot be that ground force, because we've demonstrated thoroughly that introducing our troops into the region exacerbates the problem. It doesn't make it better. Now, that's a pretty hopeless prospect. If you put all of that together, sure, it's like, how long is it going to take for that coalition to emerge? But it really ultimately is up to moderate Islam, political Islam, to deal with ISIS.
But in the meantime, and I'm thinking about not just ISIS and obviously the threat that it largely poses to people living in that region, and as we know, a number of Americans and foreigners who have been murdered by ISIS, but I'm also thinking about efforts to try to rescue Luke Summers over the weekend being held by Al-Qaeda in the, I think, the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen.
That was in Yemen.
Yemen. I mean, is it just we, meaning the United States, sort of has to learn to live with the fact that these people are going to be operating in the world, they're going to do some terrible things, they're not going to be defeated in that more sort of 20th century idea, and we just have to live with them the way perhaps we live with organized crime?
I think there's a lot to that. I think that's actually fairly wise counsel in the long run. The United States, through deliberate military action in the region, is not succeeding. The local regional people have to deal with this problem because it is their problem, not the Americans' problem. The United States can be supportive, it can be helpful, but it's going to have to stay at some distance. I think the reality is these forces emerge not just because of the United States, but because there's a real dramatic shift in the politics in the region. And it's generated internally, and the internal forces are going to have to accommodate it, deal with it, or live with it. But we cannot eliminate all evil in the world. And with the best military in the world, and we do have the best military in the world, we still cannot eliminate all evil practices in this region. It's not within our capacity to do it. The problem the administration has is not international, because bad stuff happens everywhere and we're not responsible for all of it. The problem is political, domestic. That is to say, there will always be pressure on the president, both from the populace and the right wing in the Congress, who are saying we need a vigorous, assertive, dramatic deployment of troops. It's the John McCain view of the world, if you will, which is a domestic political confrontation more than it is a different analysis of the international situation. That scares presidents. So they do things they might not otherwise choose to do, so they don't get attacked at home.
And I do want to pick up on all of that, very much worth talking about. But do you think, assuming that Ashton Carter gets approved as the Secretary of Defense, do you in any way anticipate a change in foreign policy, a more muscular foreign policy, for instance?
No, I do not. Unfortunately, we have, I think, a sufficiently muscular policy today. I don't think Carter's going to change that. I think that, you know, the what we were talking about earlier, the direction of policy is in the White House. Carter is going to become a player in those conversations, but only a player. And the general tendency in the White House right now, though, is fairly assertive. You know, cautiously assertive, but nonetheless assertive, with American air power in the region, with more troops being held in Afghanistan, with forces up around the 3,000 level in Iraq. There's going to be a continual presence of the United States in this region, and I think it's driven as much by domestic politics as it is by the situation actually within the region. Carter's not going to, I think, be more muscular about that, nor would he be convincing the White House if he were more muscular. And I think he probably knows that because he's been involved in policy conversations in this administration all through the first term when he was, you know, in the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. So he understands that. He's knowledgeable about policy issues. But in the end, he's just one player in a very White House-centric policy.
Let me get looks like Mac from Downingtown to join our conversation. Hi, Mac. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel of Marines, and I don't see how anybody gets anything done when you've got essentially two secretaries of defense who don't like each other. One that was confirmed by Congress, by the Senate, and then Susan Rice, who apparently is the one that's really in charge. Do we need to go back to the World War II model where the service chiefs had the absolute right to go directly to the president because he was the commander-in-chief?
Mac, that's an interesting question. Let me toss it to Gordon Adams, see what he has to say.
Yeah, it's an interesting model. What's interesting is that the service chiefs actually do go directly to the president today. One of the big changes that happened in law was in 1986 in something called the Goldwater-Nichols Act. And the Goldwater-Nichols Act actually stopped a practice that had become common in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which was that advice that the chairman gave to the president was funneled through the Secretary of Defense. And the chiefs did not, in fact, except in formal settings, meet with the president to talk about policy and military direction. 1986 law made the chairman of the Joint Chiefs the chief military advisor to the president, which opened a direct line of relationship for advice on military matters to the president. But here's the thing. This is a very tricky thing. We have never had a tradition of military advisors scooping, if you will, trumping political advisors to the president. Mm-hmm. It's actually not a good tradition to have. We've always had a tradition of civilian leadership. So while the military has a very proper place in providing military advice, they ought not be running around the Secretary of Defense or running around the National Security Advisor. They ought to be participating in those meetings with those people, having that discussion. But policy leaders have throughout American history told military leaders where to get off. Truman, most noticeably in 1953, when he told General Douglas MacArthur, you're out of here. For failures in the war in Korea and the drive to go up to the Chinese border in North Korea, there have always been that kind of situation. In 1990, Secretary of Defense, one of the toughest we've ever had, Dick Cheney, cashiered the Chief of Staff of the Air Force for going around him. It sets a very important tone, and what the Secretary will need, and this is a challenge for Carter, is not to be loved by the Chiefs, but to be respected by the chiefs. And I think he has the intelligence and the knowledge to be respected. That sets up the right kind of relationship.
But are you also talking about the president, that perhaps the president of the United States should be firmer with these chiefs as well?
I think most presidents have been terrified of the chiefs, honestly. The only president that I know that wasn't terrified of the chiefs in the last 70 years was Dwight Eisenhower. And there's
because
a very
he was
good reason
of them,
for that,
right?
Which everybody can know automatically.
Of course.
Every time he met with the service chiefs, he had an implicit five stars on his shoulder, which was one more than anybody else he was talking to. So he had huge credibility with the chiefs, right? Most presidents, as I said earlier, come to office without a past either military experience, especially now, without a past military experience, and with no history of a relationship with the military. So it's always a tricky relationship. And, I served for the Clinton administration. There was always a lot of nervousness in the White House about their relationship with the service chiefs and would they be respected and could they tell them what to do and so on. It's really important at the beginning of administrations for presidents to establish that relationship on a respectful, listening, proper, but authoritative tone. We have a tradition of civilian leadership over the military. It's an important tradition. We need to preserve it.
We have about a minute or a half or so before our second break here. I want to throw something else on the table, which is the Pentagon budget. I think it's something like $600 billion. And some are saying that's not enough.
Some are saying that's not enough, although I will tell you, having been involved deeply in defense budgeting for the last 40 years, I've never known an administration that said it was enough.
Really?
I've never known services that said it was enough. There is never enough in defense, but that's always true. A very wise strategist named Bernard Brody said many years ago, strategy wears a dollar sign. And what that says is not that you write strategy and then you fund it, or you write budgets and the strategy's got to fit. There's a relationship between the strategy and the budget. Strategy is always resource constrained. So in planning terms, what you have to do is calculate how much am I willing to risk? What's my level of risk here? Is it an acceptable level of risk? Is it risk I'm willing to take? And we pay the services to be conservative about that. That's their job. That's right. That's what they should be doing. We pay policy officials to say, but now, hey, hold on, wait a minute. There are two important things here. We need enough budget to fund the strategy that we want to have and accommodate the right risk. And we need the right discipline in every federal department, not just defense, but including defense, that says you guys have got to plan properly, be efficient, be effective, and be accountable. It's a message that every president has to give the Department of Defense, and it's a budgetary message. So,
well, you know, Gordon Adams, just hold on to that thought. We have to take a very short break. I want to pick up on what you just said. And again, we are talking about a whole host of things related to the Pentagon, its relationship with the White House, the fact that President Obama nominated Ashton Carter to serve as his fourth defense secretary. And again, Gordon Adams, our guest, you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. We've been talking about Chuck Hagel's tenure as Secretary of Defense, the qualifications, I should say, for Ashton Carter to succeed him. We've also been talking about the relationship between the White House and the Pentagon and the qualifications needed to carry out a U.S. foreign policy in a complicated world. And again, Gordon Adams is our guest. He's a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center, and he's a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, co-author of a book titled Mission Creep, The Militarization of Foreign Policy. And we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments for our guests or what we've been talking about? And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about your tax dollars at work, and we're talking about, of course, a foreign policy in a complicated world. Gordon Adams, I was reading actually something that Fareed Zakaria wrote about, and I kept running across this phrase over the weekend, the military-industrial congressional complex, playing off what President Eisenhower warned of back in December 2011, or 50 years ago, I should say. The idea that so many members of Congress now either have a military base in their district or a company that makes military equipment, that Congress now plays such an important part in ballooning up the Defense Department budget. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's certainly some truth to it. When Eisenhower gave his famous speech about the military-industrial complex back in 1961, his farewell address, he called it the military-industrial complex, and he left out the Congress. And his speechwriter, Malcolm Moose, who's now dead, said that he acknowledged that the word Congress had been in the original speech.
Oh, interesting.
And the president had taken it out because he didn't want to offend his friends on Capitol Hill. So what really should have been the complex was the military-industrial-congressional complex. And it's an important element in sustaining the level of defense programs and the level of defense budget. It doesn't make all of our defense policy. It's not a big monster that runs everything. But it's very difficult to reduce the level of defense spending and to make smart choices sometimes because of the impact of members of Congress with bases and products in their district and companies that are engaged in heavy lobbying, communities that don't want to lose bases. And this was the kind of thing that the president was worried about back in 1961. It continues to this day. There is still a very close interaction. It's in a sense not unusual. If you look at agricultural policy, for example, the big farming, big agriculture, the Department of Agriculture and the Ag Committees in the Congress form something that I've called an iron triangle, if you will, the triangle between the industry and the Congress and the Department of Government that they're involved in. But it's a really big one in defense because, as you say, there's $600 billion involved here. So it can play a very important role in maintaining the level of defense, but even more than that, in the kinds of things that we buy in defense, the products that we buy, the bases we keep open that we need to close, all the things that it's hard to change are in part hard to change because of the impact of this iron triangle.
Well, let me quote something that John McCain said. He talked about congressional pet projects unwanted by the administration but amounting to billions of dollars annually that waste taxpayer resources for years and sometimes for decades. Over the last decade or so, what I have described here has resulted in a massive windfall for industry, but for the taxpayer and the warfighter, it has been an absolute recipe for disaster. That's Senator John McCain.
Yeah, and Senator McCain has made that argument for a very long time. The problem with Senator McCain's argument is that Senator McCain sits on the committee that could do something about it, which is the Senate Armed Services Committee, and hasn't done very much about it. Moreover, he doesn't sit on the Appropriations Committee, which is where the money gets spent, and he hasn't done much to convince the Appropriations Committee not to engage in such pet projects. So I think his analysis is at least in part right. But if it's true that we spend money on some things in defense that we don't need to because of the impact of a military-industrial congressional complex or an iron triangle, then the question is, how does the Pentagon live within that reality? Right. Where do they find the money they need to do the things that really need to be done? And for my money, the best answer to that question is what I call the Pentagon's back office, the huge administrative overhead at the Department of Defense. You know, right now, at least 40-45% of their budget is spent in their overhead. They have 1.8 million people supporting the combat capability of 1.1 million people. That's an enormous overhead in almost any business in the world. It would be unacceptable. But the Department of Defense secretary, this is a secretary's job. This is why Hagel was not very strong. He didn't go after that back office and start cutting things internally to find the resources he needed to put into equipment and the point of the spear. He didn't take that fight on. I don't know whether Ash Carter's going to take it on either. Mm.
In fact, we have a question. Carter may have experience with defense policy, but how will he do in terms of wrangling Congress on the budget? And I guess that's the big unanswered question, at least so far.
Yeah, the budget is going to be a huge thing. We'll have a budget bill out this week. It'll be an appropriations bill. There'll be an authorizing act for defense, and it will be kind of business as usual, as Mark Thompson was saying earlier. You know, it'll be pretty much what everybody agreed to last year in terms of numbers, and Congress will finagle some of the content so that it suits congressional pet projects, as McCain's saying. The big struggle is going to be next year, and frankly, the only real budget that Ash Carter has a chance to have an impact on, the only instrument he'll have to change things in the Pentagon, is the next budget. It's the fiscal 17 budget that he will start setting up in January after he's confirmed. And that budget will be the only opportunity he has, because by the time he gets to the 18 budget, it's going to be presidential campaign time. Everything's going to be politicized. There will not be an opportunity to make much change. And in the end, the next president will have that budget to deal with. So he's got 1 year to make any difference.
But if budgets are supposed to, in some way, reflect reality, I mean, do we need more battleships? Do we need more of these big ticket items? If what the future holds are more of these special forces raids or, you know, the targeted drone strikes, things like that.
Well, you know, what's interesting, and this is an argument I know not everybody will agree with, we have a stupendous special operations and drone capability today. It's not that we especially need a lot more of them. We have nearly 60,000 special operations forces. That's bigger than the militaries of all but about 15 countries in the world. So just in special operations, we have a massive capability. We have more drone operations and operators than any other country in the world. We've already seen in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, the operations, special operations forces at work. They're at work in Africa. They're at work in the Horn of Africa. We have a very big special operations capability right now. Arguably, we could take the Army, which is right now approaching 520,000. We could take the Army down another 100,000 people, and we wouldn't lose any of that capability. Because you're right, if we're going to deploy forces, that's the most likely stuff that's going to get used. We could do that, but General Odierno, without constraints from the Secretary's office, who's the Chief of Staff of the Army, has been out campaigning vocally and visibly for the last year about how he needs to keep all of his people and more money, because he's basically fighting a bureaucratic war, not a particularly international one.
Well, and I guess competition between, what, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines for dollars?
Well, you know, it's interesting about that competition. When the budget's going down, it becomes a competition. When it's going up, it becomes a collaboration. You know, services generally don't like to poach on each other, but with the budget coming down, what General Odierno knows is that every time we've gotten out of a war and the budget's come down, it's the Army that got cut. Right? He doesn't like that. Nobody who runs the Army should like it. You know, it's almost expected that they would be on autopilot campaigning for more people. But it's what happens every time we get out of a war. It's a perfectly normal thing to have happen. We've always taken the Army down, and that has meant the Marines want to protect their flank and keep their numbers up. It means the Navy gets more money. It means the Air Force wants to buy technology. It's the usual set of competitions when the budget's coming down.
Something else, and you referenced the casualties of the wars in Afghanistan and also in Iraq. We're talking about something like 52,000 wounded veterans in need of, not all of them, but a lot of them in need of service. How do you think the Pentagon, I mean, I won't even ask it that way because I know that what the answer is, but what do you think, again, assuming Ashton Carter gets confirmed, what do you think this new Secretary of Defense can do to deal with that problem?
Well, it's been a huge problem, Marty, and it's not only the 52,000 who are allegedly wounded. We've cycled about 2 million people through those two conflicts over the past 15 years. And you have a trail of people at the post-traumatic stress syndrome level who aren't wounded and aren't counted in that 52,000, but are going to be around for a good many decades now carrying the burden of having fought in that kind of war, just as we carried hundreds of thousands of Vietnam veterans who had the same problem.
Yeah.
Right? So we're going to have a big investment here. It's going to have to be big not only at DOD, it's going to have to be huge at the Veterans Administration, because all these people are going to have to be dealt with. Linda Belms at Harvard University estimates that we got about $3 trillion worth of veterans expenses that we're going to have to absorb over the next 20 or 30 years, because those veterans are simply ought to be and have to be taken care of. So we create trauma when we go to war, and then the society has to live with that trauma. And if the war seemed like it was not very successful or not entirely necessary, it's a worse kind of trauma. Secretary Carter was known when he was deputy secretary for being a guy who went unannounced over to Walter Reed, talked to the soldiers, talked to troops in the field, did his hands-on work. And I know where he learned it. He learned it from Bill Perry, who was very much his mentor and Secretary of Defense when I was working in the White House. And Perry was absolutely magnificent at going out and sitting in the mess rooms, talking over chow with soldiers, working with their problems. It's a very important job for the Secretary of Defense.
Another domestic issue, this, of course, having to do with the sexual assaults and sexual harassment scandals within the military. And again, another challenge, whoever the new Secretary of Defense will be, to address that. A recent report saying that a number of people, and I think the majority of people reporting, were afraid that if they reported something that happened to them, some kind of sexual assault, that they would pay the price for it.
Yeah, that's obviously emerged as an issue. You know, for in some ways, the American military has always served as a kind of social laboratory. It as a command structure, it can deal with some of these issues in a more direct and, in some senses, realistic way than American society as a whole. When the military under Harry Truman was ordered to be integrated, it broke up the practice of totally separate black combat units and white combat units in the American military. It was an important step towards the civil rights movement. When we finally recently got rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the acceptability of gays in the military, it was a tremendous relief to a lot of people in the military who were struggling with that issue. Now, as we see more and more women coming into America's military, which is a fine thing, in my judgment, we're going to see this question of sexual assault become a very important issue as it is in the military. And, of course, it's important in American society as a whole. I teach at a college. At a college, we have huge issues right now about sexual assault and sexual behavior in the student community and colleges that's got to be dealt with. Well, the military is going to be, again, a kind of social laboratory for how we find a resolution to that. So it's not surprising these social issues come up. It's going to be a real challenge to the secretary to make sure this is vigorously pursued.
Ashton Carter also has this background in nuclear weapons. How important do you think that is?
Well, I think it's going to be very important, but I'm not sure it's going to be important in a way that Ashton Carter would agree with me about. The Department of Defense is undertaking right now the renewal of all three major nuclear programs, the sea-launched missiles, the ground-launched missiles, and the bomber fleet. All three of those programs are facing a renewed set of funding, and it's going to be trillions of dollars before we finish building, buying, and operating those systems as currently planned. The Department of Energy, which does our nuclear warheads, is at the same time pushing very hard to expand funding to modernize the nuclear weapons complex, to provide for funding for Sandia and Los Alamos and the labs that are involved in the Lawrence Livermore that are involved in the nuclear weapons business. We have a $1 trillion bill heading right smack towards us in the nuclear area alone. If you look at the place of nuclear weapons in American international policy today, it is minimal. We have thousands of nuclear warheads deployed in all three systems over the world. We can, analysts believe, easily survive the nuclear end of the business with half of what we have in our hands today, even with the Russians building. We can still do it, right? But that logic has not yet penetrated the iron triangle, if you will, of the nuclear weapons complex, the industry involved in it, the towns involved in it, the senators involved in it, the congresspeople involved in it, and those in the Pentagon and in the Department of Energy who want to keep that complex large. So the question I have for Ash Carter is he going to take a hard-nosed look at what we really require as opposed to the size of a nuclear establishment that has been built over the last 50, 60, 70 years?
And we're almost out of time here. Do you think he will get confirmed, Ashton Carter?
Oh, yeah, I think he's going to get confirmed. I think his confirmation hearing is going to be nasty, and not nasty because he's Ash Carter, but nasty because, you know, Carter has to deal with unruly generals. He has to deal with a micromanaging White House. He also has to deal with a very politicized Congress. They will use his confirmation hearing as a way of attacking Barack Obama and getting at the administration's policies and practices and leadership, and this whole question of micromanagement will come up. So it will be an ugly hearing. But Carter himself is more of a technocrat. He's more respected on the Hill, and in the end, he will be confirmed.
On that note, Gordon Adams, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, letting me pick your brain for the hour.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's Distinguished Fellow at the Stimson Center, professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, served in the Clinton administration, and again, co-author of a new book called Mission Creep, The Militarization of Foreign Policy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and leave us a message or comment. We'll be right back.